Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Cult Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Hey, it's Max, and we're back with the next interview in our series this week with winners of this year's George Polk Awards. And today, for the first time on the Longform Podcast, we're talking to someone from Streets Blog, which is a nonprofit publication. It covers transportation in New York City, which is where I live, which is part of why this is relevant to my interests. The other reason is that if you have been listening to the show lately, you know that I've developed a little bit of an obsession with infrastructure, so you can imagine how much I enjoyed this award-winning series. It's called Ghost Tags, that I got to talk about today with Jesse Coburn. So Jesse spent 7 months diving into the world of fake and fraudulent temporary license plates. You know the things I'm talking about. They're those paper tags that hang in the back window of newly bought cars. Probably not a thing that you have thought much about. I hadn't thought much about them, but it turns out there is a huge black market for these things because they allow drivers to not pay tolls, not pay parking tickets, drive without a license, and also get cover for much more serious crimes. It turns out the whole system is rife with fraud. It's a huge and intricate story, one that involves several states, lots of scam artists, and a massive, massive bureaucratic blind spot. And it's a story that really hadn't been reported on very much until Jesse and Streets Blog came along. So here is my conversation with Jesse Coburn about his Polk Award-winning series, Ghost Tags, and stay tuned the rest of the week. We got a few more of these conversations coming up. Hey, Jesse.
Hey.
Welcome to the show, and congratulations on your Polk Award.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
It is a richly deserved one. I have to tell you, I did not know very much about this world that you investigated. In fact, I think I knew basically nothing before I started reading your award-winning series. And the whole fucking time I was reading it, man, my jaw was just like on the floor. I learned so much, and it was really, really shocking. But instead of me poorly summarizing it, for people who haven't yet read the article, could you give me the kind of quick synopsis of the series?
Sure. So the series was about the black market for temporary license plates. Those are those paper tags that a car dealer will issue you after you buy a car from them so that you can drive off the lot before receiving your metal plates. That's the only legal way that you can obtain a temp tag, as they're known, in most states where they're issued. But what I found was that during the pandemic, New Yorkers started opening basically like sham used car dealerships in states with loose regulations, gaining access to government systems for printing temp tags and then selling them illegally on the black market. And their buyers were people with suspended driver's licenses, no car insurance, people who didn't want to have to pay tolls or traffic tickets, people who wanted to commit drive-by shootings without their license plate possibly revealing their identity, or just a whole range of bad reasons to want a fraudulent license plate. And all of this was kind of happening under the noses of industry regulators who, it turned out, were aware of the problem, but were doing a very bad job of reining it in.
Just so people listening can sort of visualize them, these are like the paper tags you see hanging in the back often of like seemingly new cars that don't have their plate set. You see them all the time. As I started to read your story, I was like, I have been seeing these way, way more in New York. They're kind of like strangely all over the place. And one of the things that I found so surprising or sort of shocking was two of the states where the regulations around issuing these tags are incredibly lax are Georgia and New Jersey. And if anyone who's ever like set up an LLC in Delaware knows, there are these like addresses in Delaware that are home to like millions and millions of LLCs, the proprietors of which never set foot in Delaware. And it's sort of a similar situation here where there's like random addresses in the middle of Jersey or Georgia where there are dozens and dozens of used car dealerships, pretty heavy air quotes, because there are no cars and there are no dealerships. They're just addresses from which people are printing these temporary tags. But one of the things I found so amazing about it was that if you got caught doing it, so you're talking about how like regulators knew, if you got caught doing it, at least in Jersey, the fine is $500.
Yeah.
So how much could you sell a tag for?
So the tags went for at least like $100, like the real ones went for at least $100 on the black market. I heard as much as like $250. So you can imagine if you sell five tags, it offsets the, you know, cost of the fine.
But these places weren't selling five tags. They were selling 10,000 tags.
Yeah. I found one dealership that issued 36,000 temp tags in 1 year while displaying no other discernible business activity. They were eventually shut down for fraudulently issuing tags, but their fine was $500. So, you know, they could have made, if they sold all of those tags, they could have made millions of dollars. I should note that the owner of that dealership denied that he had sold tags, but declined to explain all these strange things about his business. But there were other dealers that admitted to me that they had sold tags, that they had sold thousands of tags. And the one dealer who sort of was straightforward about his profits from it, he told me he sold 200 tags and made $18,000. And then I think he had like $1,000 fine or something. And that was it. So a good piece of business for him.
A good piece of business across the board. I mean, you can understand why people would start doing it. And you can understand why people would find these tags appealing. You did get into like much more serious crimes, but it seemed like for some significant portion of people, it literally was just like not having to pay tolls.
Yeah.
What was the number that like the Port Authority missed out on?
It was hard to pin this down because a lot of the tolling agencies didn't separate out tolls lost due to fraudulent temporary license plates. The only agency that did is the MTA, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, which runs like, I think like around a dozen tolling bridges around New York City. And they said that they were losing like $11 million a year just due to fraudulent temporary license plates. But, you know, there's many other tolling agencies in the city, and there's the Department of Transportation, which, you know, has its red light and speed camera program, which is also issuing tickets. Congestion pricing is going to be based on cameras. That's going to start in a few months in the city. So when you sort of start thinking about, well, like how much money are we really losing due to this issue? I mean, it's easy to imagine that just in New York alone, it's going into the tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars a year.
Tell me a little bit about your experience of reporting it. I know it was like a really long project for you. How did you get onto the story? What was your first step? How do you attack a project like this?
So it started for me, I think, in the summer of 2021, when I just started noticing tons of temporary license plates on cars in my neighborhood in Brooklyn. And it struck me as odd. You know, a lot of these tags were from Texas or Georgia. And I like looked up temp tags and saw like, oh, this is what you get when you buy a car. And it just seemed improbable to me that so many people had just bought cars in like Texas and all happened to drive to
your neighborhood.
Exactly. So I tried to persuade my editor to let me look into it. He wasn't really interested at the time. So I just started kind of tracking the issue. And the coverage in New York, there was coverage of the issue in New York, but it was a lot of like kind of tabloid items covering a NYPD press conference touting like a crackdown on drivers using these tags. Mm-hmm. But I felt like the coverage in New York left a lot of questions unanswered, like who was producing these tags, how they were getting away with it, you know, who was buying these tags, why they were buying them. There was good coverage of the issue in Texas, but its focus was really local. And it was also kind of driven by law enforcement. So I just felt like there was something weird going on here that I wanted to look into, eventually persuaded my editor to let me work on it.
Can I ask you about that editor thing just for a second? I don't want you to throw your boss under the bus, but in a practical sense, like when you get told like, I don't think there's anything there, and you're like, I don't know, I think there is. What in a day-to-day way, how do you make that happen?
I think it was like mostly me bugging my editor like every few weeks, you know, like sending him a story on Slack being like, hey, look at this, kind of weird, huh? You know, but I had other stuff that I was working on that I was into and that he was into. I think eventually I like brought up the Martin Scorsese thing of like one for the studio, one for me,
Totally.
You know, I was like, okay, I just like gave you a nice meaty, you know, deep dive on traffic violence around city schools, which feels like more in Streets Blog's wheelhouse. So like, give me like a little time to like look into this temp tax thing.
Did you just Slack your editor, I told you so, when you won the Polk Award? Or did you send him like a letter in the mail? How'd that work?
I gave him a call. I mean, I think I was too surprised to be, you know, to kind of like dig him on that. So... We were both just kind of like, I can't believe it.
Well, I applaud your lack of pettiness, but let's keep going with the reporting process. So there's some work being done in Texas, but it's very local. You see NYPD folks coming out and saying, we're going to do a crackdown. But these questions, who is making them? Why are they making them? Who's buying them? How do you go about trying to answer those?
So I did two things right away. The first was I started submitting public records requests to the motor vehicle agencies in New Jersey and Georgia for data on temp tags being issued by car dealers in the state. And that became kind of the foundation of the story, because what I got back was eventually by the end, I had data on all of the temp tags issued by every used car dealer in those two states since like 2019. It was something like 4 million tags issued by 10,000 dealers. And right away, that kind of like showed me the story. Like I could see who the dealerships were that were issuing the most tags. And it was like these no-name dealerships that were just issuing massive numbers of tags, you know, thousands, tens of thousands in a year. By contrast, the average New Jersey car dealer issues like 150 temp tags a year. So there was something very unusual about these dealerships. Then I would look them up online and I could find nothing about them. They had no website, no online inventory. They weren't even listed on Google Maps. They had none of the trappings of a successful car dealership that I could explain how many tags they were issuing.
Was there any part of you when you would like Google one of these places and nothing came up that you were like, I must have something about this wrong? Like it just, it seems so wild to me. I wonder what the experience was when you're just like, wait, this is not a business on the internet and they issued, you know, tens of thousands of tags last year.
It didn't make any sense to me. I didn't really believe what I was seeing, which is why I kind of undertook the next thing I did, which was I just started cold calling random used car dealers in New Jersey, being like, what's going on with New Jersey temp tags? You know, I'm like seeing tons of them in the city. I have this data showing these random dealerships are issuing tons of them. Like, do you know about this? And I think I had to call like a dozen dealers before I got one to like speak to me for more than 2 minutes. You know, I was getting a lot of people hanging up on me or saying, I don't know what you're talking about. People very defensive about it. But then I got this guy on the phone named Abdul, who was a used car dealer in Jersey City. And he was like, oh yeah, I know all about that. Like, I'll tell you about it. And then we talked for like an hour and it was so crazy what he was telling me that I was like, I need to come see you. I went out the next day. I spent like 5 hours at his dealership talking to him. And he basically just, he knew everything. At least he knew like the rough outlines of what was going on, because he knew dealers who were selling temp tags and he knew where they were based and he knew how the whole scam worked. And he just told me. And what he told me, like, I ended up doing months of reporting after I first spoke to him. Everything he told me proved true. So that was really helpful, because it was like sort of stress testing the premise that I had. And it was like, yeah, no, that's real. That's really going on.
What do you think his incentive was to walk you through the scam?
Abdul is like the best kind of source you can find, because he seemingly was motivated exclusively by his disgust at other people in his industry who were doing wrong and who were giving honest used car dealers like him a bad name. He had a lot of integrity. He was candid. He was smart. And he just talked, you know. I mean, that's just like the perfect combination in a source.
So you have your 5 hours with Abdul, and then you start checking out what he's saying, and it all leads up. And then how do you start thinking about how to craft that kind of thing into like a narrative, you know, because it's so sort of sprawling. It's a little difficult to understand. It's hard to find characters sort of outside of him. How do you tell a story around this?
Yeah, it was hard. I mean, it's a complicated story. You know, one thing that I definitely needed was I needed a lot of people who are sort of connected to this black market to talk to me. And that ended up being the bulk of the reporting, was finding people who would admit to me that they had sold temp tags, told me how it worked, and then find people who would admit to having bought temp tags illegally. The story ended up becoming a four-part series. And I decided to lead the first story with an account of a man who was run over and killed in Brooklyn in 2022 by a driver with a suspended license who was using a New Jersey temp tag, who had a New Jersey temp tag on his car, which I, through reporting, determined to be have been fraudulently issued. I wanted to start with him because I felt like that was sort of like a way into the story, you know, just focusing on the sort of harm done due to this black market. And then I was able to basically trace that temp tag back from that fatal car crash to this kind of dubious used car dealership from New Jersey that issued tons of tags with no other discernible business activity. And I was able to prove that that tag was fraudulent. So it felt like it sort of contained all of the key elements of the story. Also, this dealership was based at one of those facilities you mentioned where hundreds of used car dealers are registered, but there's no cars outside. So I thought, you know, sort of focusing on one story would sort of help the reader get into it. And then I ended up breaking up the later stories to focus on sort of different key players in the black market. I thought that would sort of like, I don't know, help the reader kind of get through what is a lot of dense material.
Did the material end up feeling dense to you in the end? Like, was it hard for you to figure out exactly what was going on, or did it really just become a sort of like repertorial challenge of getting people to actually go on the record with you?
It was definitely hard finding people to go on the record. And that was honestly just like a numbers game. Like, I just had to keep calling people until I found people who, for whatever reason, agreed to talk to me and give me their names.
That's just like a brute force thing. Like, how long was that part of your process? How much time were you spending just calling and knocking on doors and stuff?
That was months. That was a long time.
Were there moments in there where you were discouraged?
Oh, yeah. All the time. Yeah, I mean, there were times reporting the story that I thought it was terrible, you know, that I was like, why am I spending so much time looking into these paper license plates? But then occasionally you would just have an interview that was so eye-opening, or so it just was sort of like able to pierce through your cynicism, my cynicism about the story, and make me excited about it again.
Is there a moment you're thinking of when you say that?
Well, I remember when I first got a temp tag buyer to talk to me, and that was really hard. It was hard to find people who would admit to like having committed this crime and tell me about it. And there was a period where I was just biking around looking at cars with temp tags on them and leaving letters on the windshield saying, hey, well, you know, will you give me a call? I want to talk to you about your license plate.
Did anyone call you?
No.
that was a 0% success rate?
0%. Yeah. But what was much more successful, what was actually a 100% success rate, was when I figured out how to read the New York City criminal court calendars to identify people who had hearings that day in the city who likely had been arrested for having a fraudulent temp tag, which took a while because the online court system is very like web 1.0, but there's tons of valuable information in there if you can sort of figure it out. And so there was a period of weeks where every morning I would look at the court calendars and I would look for people who had hearings for the charge of criminal possession of a forged instrument, which is what you get if you have been caught driving with a fraudulent temp tag, or if you like have a fake ID, for example, and also had other charges related to like car related crimes, you know, like driving on a suspended license or DUI or things like that. I thought if someone had those two crimes together, those two charges together, they likely had a temp tag. And then I would go to the court where their hearing was and just sit around all day until they were called. And after their hearing or whatever, I would just follow them out of court and I introduced myself and asked them about their temp tag. And they talked to me, all of them. All of them talked to me. So, and that was really helpful. And there was one guy who was just like, oh yeah, man, I've had like 8 or 9 temp tags. Like, I'm from Bushwick. Like, no one there wants to pay the parking tickets. And that, I don't know, it was just like such a good quote and such a sort of affirmation of like, oh, there's this whole cohort of people in the city who just like don't want the sort of responsibilities that come with car ownership. And this is their way of avoiding that responsibility.
Totally. Yeah. That quote hit me really hard too, because there are so many really serious moments. I mean, hit and runs and people dying, and the stakes couldn't be higher. And part of the way that I could wrap my head around the scale was just like, this is also just a way to not pay parking tickets. Like, just not worry about alternate side parking.
Yeah, the reasons that people buy temp tags range from the like very banal to the very serious.
Yeah. Just so for people scoring at home, the takeaway from that seems to be, if you are trying to contact someone before they have been convicted of a crime, about the crime that they are committing, they are very unlikely to talk to you. But if you go and talk to them after they've already been caught and have had their repercussions, then they'll talk to you about it.
I think so. I also think, I was wondering about this after, why people were so candid with me. Part of it was that they had just appeared in court, and court is like a place that requires like a certain level of transparency and sort of honesty about whatever you've done. And so I think they were maybe in a mode where they were more willing to be forthcoming about whatever they had done.
That's interesting. That's a pretty tangible reporting tip. Were there other things reporting this story that surprised you?
I was surprised by how easy it was to carry out this scam. In New Jersey and Georgia, the two states that I focused on in the series, the regulations made it pretty easy to obtain used car dealership credentials. And once you had them, there were seemingly no guardrails to prevent an unscrupulous dealer from printing and illegally selling vast numbers of temp tags. So in Georgia, for example, to become a used car dealer, you don't have to actually have space to display any cars for sale, and you don't need to keep business hours. In both states, I found evidence of dealers printing tons of temp tags from New York. You know, I spoke to a woman who had a New Jersey used car dealership. She was just printing New Jersey, official New Jersey temp tags from New York City and then selling them in Queens. So that seems bad.
Wild.
And wild. The online systems for generating these temp tags, you basically didn't have to verify any of the information you were plugging into the system to prove that, you know, the temp tag you were issuing was part of a legitimate sale. So Abdul, to demonstrate this to me, he drew up a temp tag for New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy, as if Phil Murphy had just bought a car from him, which he hadn't. But that's how easy it is. You can just
down to using like the address of the governor's mansion.
Yes, you can just lie to these systems, and they won't stop you.
Was there anything in it for the states in being so lax? Was it simply like not occurring to them that people would do this, or was there some other incentive to have it be so easy?
The most candid answer I got on that came at a public hearing in Georgia, at which some regulators talked about the issue. And one of them said, you know, when we set up this temp tag system, it was built on a sort of like good faith in the honesty of the dealers. We trusted that they would use the system in an honest way and that they would follow the rules. So it kind of just seems like a major oversight on their part, that they didn't build in more safeguards to prevent this sort of fraud from happening. But I guess most generously, you could say that they never saw it coming. Mm-hmm. Now, in New Jersey, it's harder to be as generous about it because I found reports dating back to like 2010 of temp tag fraud, specifically at these facilities we've been talking about, these multi-dealer locations where like dozens or hundreds of no-show dealers are registered. So the state has known about the problems there for a long time. I think it was only during the pandemic where the scale of the problem really exploded. And by then it was kind of too late for them to stop it. I will say in New Jersey's defense, they have since passed a law that's really overhauling its temp tag system. So I do think that they are getting a handle on the problem now.
It's interesting. I mean, it's a way of understanding sort of bureaucracy at that level in some way, which is like, you know, the technology moves faster than this sort of bureaucracy is totally equipped for. It seems, you know, someone somewhere just assumes sort of the best. You sort of think, why would this ever be a problem? And then it's like, it is a problem, but it's not a big enough problem to actually deal with and focus on. Until it is, you know?
Yeah, I think part of the issue is that the sort of like responsibility for it feels kind of diffuse. Mm-hmm. You know, in New Jersey, the Motor Vehicle Commission oversees the car dealers and the tags that they print. But once those tags go out into the world, it's law enforcement's problem. And retired auto crime detectives talk to me about this problem as like kind of a game of whack-a-mole. Like you find a driver, you bust them for temp tags, but like they're still being churned out somewhere else, and that's across state lines. And so it's like, you know, someone else's problem. It felt like there was a lot of someone else's problem in dealing with this.
Yeah, it is. It's like the whole thing is like just a glitch. It just sort of slides through a bunch of different systems, and no one feels like it's theirs exactly to catch.
Yeah, you could imagine this like never having become a problem. Because it's so weird, right? Like, what a weird scam, you know? Totally. Like, I'm gonna print and sell tens of thousands of paper license plates, but someone figured it out, and then a lot more people kind of followed, and then it just exploded.
It does make you think about what are all the other scams like this, where the bureaucracy sort of like isn't set up to catch them, isn't set up to protect against them, that just haven't quite become that visible.
Totally. I mean, I think that's why cars and transportation and the public realm generally is sort of fruitful terrain for investigative reporting, because you can see it, can see everything that's happening. And this story just started with me noticing something in public space and wondering about it and looking into it. And sure enough, there was something there. So car-related crimes are not stuff that's happening hidden away in boardrooms, you know, top of some skyscraper somewhere. It's just happening on the street. And that, you know, kind of gives you an advantage as a reporter.
Yeah. And also another advantage is that the next time you see it and you say something to your editor, they're probably going to have to be like, go ahead and run at that.
I think he has to let me at this point.
Yeah. You got that. You never even sent the I told you so note. You have to be you have to be allowed to do it. There's one more thing I wanted to ask you about before we go, which is the first three parts of the series are all sort of in the same style and tone. They're looking at this problem from both like a quite small scale, but also from a 30,000 foot view and from different perspectives. There's people selling the tags, there's people buying the tags, there's people who are the landlords of these fake car dealerships. But the fourth installment felt different to me. And I wonder if both you could, again, just for listeners who haven't read it yet, tell me what that fourth installment was about and also why it was important to you to do it.
So the fourth installment, which published a couple months after the rest of the series, was about this kid, Kareem, who unwittingly became a courier in an illegal temp tag distribution scheme in the tri-state area. And I wanted to write that story because I just thought it was such a great story. And Kareem was an open book with us. He told us very candidly about his experience. And he also shared with us this trove of documentary evidence revealing how this whole scam worked. You know, he shared with us months of Telegram chat logs with his employers, where they were sort of instructing him and seemingly dozens of other delivery workers on, you know, where to deliver tags and who the buyers were and all that. And the thing that I liked about reporting that story was Kareem didn't know who his employers were. They never identified themselves to him. And I should say, just to explain, he got this job from a gig that was posted on Craigslist that sounded totally innocuous. Kareem's never owned a car, so he didn't know what Tim Tags were or how they were legally acquired. So he didn't know anything about this, which is how he didn't realize that this whole operation was illegal. But anyways, you know, through this documentary evidence and his accounts, I was sort of able to follow this trail of breadcrumbs back to the people who appeared to be behind the operation and was able to write about who those people were. And it just felt like, you know, the rest of the series is like this sort of like big systemic problem type of investigative project. But here I was able to write more of a narrative just about this one guy's experience getting kind of mixed up with this whole legal underworld.
Part of what came through also was that it was a scam and it was a repeatable scam. And the person who was perpetrating it had a bunch of other scams. Like, you see how this stuff works and grows and how essentially like scams can go viral. So something like this can balloon very quickly in the pandemic when no one really thought, you know, even if it was a little bit of a problem, no one thought anything like that could happen because it's so repeatable. I mean, the person that you found is someone who's been doing stuff on the generously the margins of legality for a long time. And I don't know, I just found that part of it interesting too, is like a way of understanding, you know, the first three pieces were about the system and how it worked. But that last one felt like to me like, oh, and this is how it spreads. Is there a bunch of people who this is how they live their lives? Is like they're looking for the next opening, the next, you know, glitch that they can take advantage of.
Yeah. His career was interesting. He was sort of this like omnidirectional entrepreneur who had a kind of like throw it at the wall and see if it sticks approach to making a living. And often his pursuits seem to have not worked out or to have landed him in trouble.
Omnidirectional entrepreneur is a very generous term.
Yeah. Well, I liked that guy. I mean, I enjoyed reporting on him. He was a very interesting character. You know, I should say that he did deny having been involved in the operation that employed Kareem, but 11 days after that story came out, New Jersey did investigate his car dealership and found that they were issuing temp tags illegally and shut them down and fined them. So there was something going on there.
Do you think in general, despite the fact that it's no one's total responsibility, do you think that this is a, for lack of a better word, glitch that is going to get under control?
I think it could. I mean, one thing that was notable to me in the reporting was that there are many states that simply don't have this problem. New York doesn't have this problem because it regulates car dealers and temp tags in a completely different way than states like New Jersey and Georgia. So if New Jersey and Georgia want to solve this problem, if other states where this is a problem want to solve this problem, they simply have to replicate the laws and regulations that exist in states where this isn't a problem. Then it's just a matter of political will, I guess, of actually fixing it.
Yeah, the bureaucracy, it'll just fix it like that. That's what you learned.
That's how it normally works.
Hey, Jesse, thank you so much for doing this. And congratulations again on the Polk Award. It's really deserved. The story's incredible.
Thank you. And thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Longform. Our editor on this episode was Jackie Sajiko. Thanks to her. Thanks to Jesse Coburn for taking the time to chat with me. Thanks to John Darton and everyone over at the Polk Awards who make this series possible. We'll be back with another episode, a new winner, tomorrow.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright. exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within art, beats, and lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari, W, and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.